Live from the Regis Suites in Phoenix, Arizona, you're listening to Breakthrough Thinking. Hi, everyone. Welcome to the show. I'm Dave Isaac, the host. And if it's the second Monday and Tuesday of each month from 3 to 4, it is Understanding Autism, starring none other than Kimberly Isaac and Paul Loudon. Guys, how are you?
Doing well.
Doing all right.
Wow, all the way from Houston. I was in Houston.
You were?
Yeah. Just for like 15 minutes.
Okay, so you passed through.
Yeah, but it was a big airport, though.
Bush Intercontinental?
I'm not sure. Which one? I was?
Yeah.
That was big.
You don't say big airport about hobbies. So.
Right.
It was big. It was cool, though. Nice airport. I liked it.
I haven't been to it in ages, so I don't know.
Yeah, it was very – oh, you fly out of hobby?
I fly out of hobby since it's basically Southwest's personal airport at the moment. So.
Oh, pretty
that's
much,
interesting.
Yeah.
Wow, really? It was very cool, though. It was nice and – big, big airport. I was surprised. I was
well, everything's bigger in Texas, except Hobby Airport.
Yeah. But when I heard there was
no, it's just better.
It's just better.
I wanted to stay for a night and go to Rudy's or something, but I didn't do that. So anyway, so guys, this is great. Understanding Autism, always a phenomenal show, explaining key issues and suggestions and giving hope and faith to anyone on the spectrum. And, of course, Kim, RDI specialist. And Paul Loudon on the spectrum.
Yes.
And why don't you explain a little further, perhaps, what you do?
Yeah, you know, we should introduce ourselves.
Yeah.
We don't always do that. But just briefly, I'm Kim Isaac, and I've been in the field of autism for almost 17 years now. And I specialize in working with teens and adults on the autism spectrum. And I'm a certified RDI program consultant.
And Paul.
I am an adult on the autism spectrum. I'm 30, and it was almost 8 years ago, because it was right when I turned 23, and I'm 2 months from turning 31, that I was diagnosed with Asperger's, which is now an outdated diagnosis, but it is a place on the autism spectrum. And actually, that sort of leads into what we're going to be talking about, because with the DSM-4 being retired for the DSM-5 and us having a new autism diagnosis out there, we're going to be talking today and tomorrow, about what autism is and isn't, both from a diagnostic side and a practical side, both for all of our new listeners out there. We seem to hopefully have an influx of new listeners at the moment, but also as a review and going back into it with the changes so we can let people know what we mean when we're talking about autism and help lead to some discussion and questions about, you know, helping people to understand it.
You know, what's really unique and what I really think is valuable is that we have Kim, who is, you know, is a specialist for many years. What did you say, 17, I think?
Yeah.
And Paul has the experience of being on the spectrum, looking sort of inside out, and you're looking outside in. A very unique combination, very valuable for any listeners, and gives hope for, like I said, to caregivers, parents, and also people like Paul, you in earlier shows, you weren't really sure what you had, and that's a little nerve-wracking when you don't know, but when you know, there was some type of relief.
Yeah, I mean, that was my personal experience with my diagnosis originally. It's just that I ran into a lot of problems, and nothing anyone seemed to think it was. The regular way of approaching those didn't seem to help with, you know, ADD and things like that, just general depression. But once we got the autism diagnosis, it really gave us the tools to start working on it. So hopefully, knowing more about autism can also be helpful if you have someone who's just having challenges that might be similar to autism or whatever, that, you know, just to preface everything, despite everything we tell you, you still need a professional diagnosis. But what we're telling you may help you with either knowing what kind of diagnosis to look for or understanding someone who's close to you who is diagnosed and how to interact with them in a more positive way.
So, Kim, where do you want to start?
Well, I actually want to start just something really, really simple is, you know, some people, there's a lot of terms that are thrown around when it comes to autism. So you hear the word autism, you might hear autism spectrum disorders, you might hear Asperger's, you might hear the abbreviation ASD. Basically, just to kind of clarify and give everybody, some clarity on these terms is the overall term for all of these things is autism spectrum disorders. And you might also hear people refer to that as ASD. And we may refer to it that way in the show too. So I just wanted to get that out there. And then Asperger's, as Paul was saying, is no longer a specific diagnosis in the DSM-5, but it is part of autism spectrum disorders.
And just as a note, the DSM-5 does explicitly say that anyone diagnosed with PDD in OS, which is a pervasive development disorder not otherwise specified, which was just a way of saying they have autism-like symptoms, but we don't have a specific diagnosis for this, so we're going to put it in this category until we fine-tune things. People with Asperger's and people with the original autism diagnosis all fall into the autism diagnosis and the new one, and any old diagnoses carry over. So you don't need to go and see a doctor again and get re-diagnosed. The DSM says we recognize that you don't get a diagnosis unless there's something causing you significant trials in life and significant challenges, and old diagnoses are valid. The only reason to get a new diagnosis is if you think, looking at the new ones, that you might fall into one that better describes your specific challenges and you want to get it narrowed or down to one of the new categories. But other than that, all of the old diagnoses still hold, and any doctor should be willing to recognize and it as it stands.
Yeah, that's a really good point. I'm glad you mentioned that to listeners, because I've had questions like that. Does, you know, because there's been a change, do we need to all go get, you know, re-diagnosed? And Paul's right, you don't.
And I'm sort of thinking the reason for an accurate diagnosis, it leads to proper treatment, correct?
Yeah, absolutely.
You never want to hesitate to get evaluated or whatever. If you feel like there's something missing in terms of how people are approaching your personal challenges or the challenges you have in life, because with everything, a better diagnosis means a better treatment plan. As they say in, handicraft, measure twice, cut once. It's a very simple way of putting it, but it means always make sure you know what you're doing before you start doing anything. And if you don't do that, you're not necessarily going to get anywhere good.
And, Kim, how do we – I don't know if you were going to go into this, but I'm sort of curious. I'm sort of like a listener in studio. But what I'm curious about is how do people, if they suspect they have someone they know on the spectrum – where do they go? Is that going to be part of your discussion
today?
Well,
it is, and I'm glad I was just going to bring this up, actually, after what Paul said, is because not everybody is actually a qualified diagnostician. And so it's really important that a person receives a diagnosis from a qualified diagnostician. And those people are clinical psychologists, psychiatrists, developmental pediatricians. And, you know, so you also want to ask these professionals just to be sure, you know, that they have the proper credentials to do it, but those are usually the groups that are qualified to make a diagnosis.
And it may be also worth asking, like, do you have much experience with autism?
Yes.
Just because someone who has the specific knowledge from the book or whatever may not have enough experience to one thing about the DSM-5's definition of autism is it says clearly that the symptoms need to be basically present from an extremely young age, but they may not have always been noticeable until social pressures became too much. So the symptoms may have been present, but not significant in an impairing way and not significant in a way that you even really took note of them until after the fact. But it also mentions that these symptoms also may be covered if you're far enough late in life that someone has developed coping strategies. So in some cases, you want someone who has enough experience with autism to ask appropriate questions, searching back through your history, trying to find the point, you know, where the symptoms were a problem, because autism is something that, you know, it doesn't necessarily show up immediately, even if it is developmental and always there, so much as it shows up when outside pressure moves past your ability to deal with it. And then if you have one of the, quote, higher functioning versions of autism where you are still able to go about in day-to-day life with various challenges, but you can go out among people and interact with them, you may eventually learn skills to hide it. And hiding it and dealing with it doesn't mean you don't have the depression, the anxiety, and need real help. And the DSM, the current DSM, really acknowledges this fact that autism is something that's there underneath your behaviors, and that the real trick to diagnosing it is being able to look across the entire history of behaviors and looking for the challenges and stresses that you've had during that time. So, you know, someone attempting a diagnosis who doesn't really have a firm grasp on autism may not really know how to look at the history of the behavior, talk to the parents about the behavior of the child, question the child himself or herself, so asking about the experience they've had with autism, and if you really suspect autism, maybe asking them if they can recommend a specialist or someone they know in the area who does have, you know, a significant experience with it could be beneficial. Or again, if you know someone who has experience with autism but doesn't have the criteria to diagnose it, it might be worth asking them to come in and see if they can collaborate, where one can share their experience and the other one can share the ability to actually give an accurate diagnosis. That just keep the idea open that it's worthwhile looking for experience.
Very important. I've known a lot of individuals that have received diagnosis from different qualified professionals who are just inaccurate diagnosis for various reasons. And so, you know, having that, knowing that you can be empowered to ask questions, it's okay to question, you know, the professionals you work with. In fact, I think it's appropriate. You know, you want to be sure that you know who you're working with. This is, you know, a person's life. It's a serious topic. You want to be able to trust the person that you're going to for help. And so definitely important to ask about their level of experience as well.
So are there trusted reference sites? I'm suspecting with your Facebook page and the communications you have, you're probably available, or do you have reference sites that people can go to as a starting point?
I would say the Autism Society of America, Autism Speaks, one of the major autism foundations, they usually have sections for identifying autism or diagnosis that can give you advice on signs and can give you advice on finding a reputable person in your area for diagnosis. So I think that there are really big foundations out there who are sort of good at this part of it. Especially, they also have, you know, communities around them and things like that. So,
and the Autism Society is great because they have chapters, different cities or chapters. So, like, here we have a Phoenix chapter, there's a Houston chapter. So, you know, it's important to, because sometimes, you know, people could be listening from all over. So, you know, just know that those resources from the Autism Society of America are available to more locally.
So that's a really good starting place. But you always encourage questions off of your Facebook, right?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, and I do. I probably do have some resources. I'm definitely open to questions if people want to, you know, post them on there. I know some excellent people here in, you know, the Phoenix, Scottsdale area, and a couple of other cities. So we can certainly, you know, help out some of our listeners with that too.
So this is an excellent resource in itself, this Understanding Autism radio show.
Yeah.
Kim and Paul. Anyway, let's take a quick break right now. When we come back, we'll continue our discussion, What Autism Is and Isn't, starring Kimberly Isaac and Paul Loudon, all the way from Houston, Texas. And we'll be right back.
At Beerenbaum Baum and Spean PC, we want to help you work on your business, not in your business. We take a simple approach. You know your business. Our firm gives you the information to make those decisions better. Our firm takes a proactive approach to your accounting needs, and if you look behind the numbers, you'll find there are hidden opportunities that we try to impart on you. Communication is the key to that understanding, and there is no charge for brief phone calls. Contact us at 602-266-5633 or email us at mitch@jfbpc.com. Beerenbaum and Spean works to increase your understanding of your business in order to make the decisions necessary to move your business forward.
Ridenour, Heinzen & Lewis is a multi-practice law firm, ideally equipped to assist with a broad range of legal and business issues, corporate and financial transactions. real estate, commercial, litigation, bankruptcy, and private client practice. Reidenauer, Heinten & Lewis is a law firm that bases its practice on understanding the businesses of their clients, and they use this insight to meet each client's unique and evolving legal challenges. Call or click today, 602-254-9900. Find them on the web at rhkl-law.com.
Do you owe money to the IRS? Have you heard of possible payment options such as a partial payment installment agreement, offering compromise, or not currently collectible status? Knowing that you have options and what those options are will greatly relieve your worry and stress. Hi, my name is Dave Isaac, CPA and former government tax auditor. If you are curious as to what options may be available to you if you owe money to the IRS, my 25 years experience as a CPA may very well help you in these times of uncertainty. Stop worrying and start learning about what options you have. If you just want to talk to someone about your IRS debt or want specific advice, I invite you to call me at 602-625-3074. That is 602-625-3074. And when you call, ask for me, Dave Isaac, CPA and former government tax auditor.
And welcome back again. You are listening to Breakthrough Thinking live here at the Regis Suites in Phoenix, Arizona. And it is the second Monday and or Tuesday of each month from 3 to 4, Understanding Autism, starring Paul Loudon and Kimberly Isaac. We're talking about what autism is and is not. And Kim, you wanted to start what it is not.
I did. I wanted to start with that. So what autism is not, it's not a behavioral disorder. And I think that the awareness and understanding of that is shifting, but I still hear people refer to autism as a behavioral disorder. So even though we talk about symptoms and observable behaviors, it's not actually a behavioral disorder.
You may want to clarify what you mean by behavioral disorder, too.
Yeah, well, that, you know, that these people are having these, you know, it's simply behaviors that we need to change or correct, or, you know, behaviors that are odd, that aren't typical, aren't normal, that we want to shape into, you know, normal behaviors. So specifically the action.
So a behavioral disorder is a disorder where the disorder is specifically the behaviors and not something behind them.
Right. Or sometimes people might clump into there, though, that it's a choice. You know, I don't hear this too much, but they're just choosing to act out, things like that. But some people still have that school of thought that it's under the person's control, more so than it actually is.
So you're saying that if what it is not a behavioral disorder. So I think if you look at it and extend that out, then you shouldn't treat it just as a behavior modification.
Right. And so even though we need behavior to help us, you know, understand what's going on, we can't just, you know, behavior solely. But behavior represents something that's happening or not happening in the brain.
So something's motivating the behavior, saying. But there's some cause.
There's
the behavior's a symptom, and the cause is behind it.
Right.
That makes sense.
So there's always a reason, and so it's important to, you know, to be mindful of that. Autism is also, I've heard this one, is just all in one's head, especially for the teens and adults that I work with. I hear that it's just all in your mind. If you would just think positively, or, you know, stop complaining, or, you know, putting it more on them in terms of their attitude and, you know, and, like, again, sort of like it's their choice, you know, to have the problems that they have. And definitely autism is not a choice. It's actually a physical, you know, developmental disorder. If you were to take brain scans of people on the spectrum, their brains actually physically look different. They've been architected differently. Different pathways have developed. So, you know, sometimes, mostly when you hear, like, people who are higher functioning, those are the guys that get a lot of that maybe Paul has some more experience he can share with, you know, people just saying, oh, just get over it. What's the big deal? What's the problem? Why is it so hard?
Have you heard that before, Paul?
What I hear a lot of is sort of, if you can explain it so well, why can't you change it? And that's, you know, that's a hard one to answer, because it's like, well, you know, if I was in a wheelchair, I might be able to tell you all about, you know, how I broke my back, how it healed differently, you know, why those connections don't work. It's the same thing. I can know a lot about it, but that doesn't make the connections in my brain different. That autism isn't about what you do so much as what you can't do. And that's sort of the hard part, is that you see what someone's doing. That's what you observe. You can't see what they didn't do, and you can't see why they didn't do it. And that's sort of where autism is that, like, you don't pick up certain signs. You don't understand, you know, certain things about tone of voice. Autism is a disorder that is almost entirely constructed of things that you don't do, at least the social part of it is. And, you know, knowing to do them, that's different than knowing how to do them. You know, if you're in the middle of a math test and you see a problem, you know you need to do it, but maybe you can't remember the formula. But even that you're explicitly prompted to do it. But maybe when you're outside, you know, that math formula might be useful in day-to-day life, but it never even occurs to you to apply it to make life better. That it's about a different way of seeing things, and it's something that sort of has to be developed gradually. I often get people who, you know, respond to me with, you know, I didn't think of it that way, because I look at problems a different way. And it's sort of the other thing is, you don't think of it my way and I don't think of it your way. And learning to think of it your way and developing those skills is a slow and time-consuming process. And so it's one of those things where, you know, just because I can talk well about it and express and everything doesn't mean I don't go home and need 2 days of downtime afterwards, because it does, you know, burn me out very quickly and very thoroughly. And so one of the big challenges as someone higher functioning is, you know, that people think autism is entirely behavioral, as Kim mentioned. So when you're not exhibiting the behaviors, they think you're not autistic. And that's a real challenge in day-to-day life. It's a challenge in getting the help that you need, because they're like, well, if you could come here and sit down with me and talk to me about needing this help and talk to me about, you know, needing this support, then, you know, you're self-aware enough that you should be able to sort of manage a lot of this on your own. You know, if you can tell me the challenges that you would have working for me, then why can't you address them? It's just a very difficult thing for people to understand that it really is in the brain, that it really is things that you can't do, even if you're aware of them, even if you can see it afterwards and know exactly what you did wrong. At the time it's happening, you can't see it.
So can you give an example of what people can't do and what they can't see, the connection? I know you've talked about it in previous shows, especially nonverbal cues. It's like different channels.
I was going to say, I have something.
It's really hard for me to give an example ahead of time because I can't see them.
Gotcha.
So you know, if I look back at something, I might pick up, you know, times where I've missed sarcasm or I haven't understood, you know, someone, you know, mentions that, you know, something needs to get done, and I don't get that they're implying that they think I should do it, you know, or whatever. Like, I'll, there's just a lot of things where the connections aren't made. And afterwards, when someone says, so what do you think happened, you can look back at it and consciously examine it and pick that up. But when you're acting in a normal day-to-day life, we don't spend every moment of our day consciously examining everything someone says to us.
Right.
We don't have the time for that. We just physically can't. So even if you can spot it consciously, it's the subconscious that needs to develop that ability to pick out when something requires that second look and that second thought. And so, you know, there you go. It misses it a lot.
And on that note, I just want to say, too, that, you know, an example that people, listeners, could probably relate to is just the idea of that face-to-face interaction. And if you think about the brain being architected differently, you know, we have these things called neural pathways, these little roads or highways in our brain. And in typical development, we develop many, many of them that interconnect to different parts of the brain in a very specific way. And so there are many highways, and they're connected to all these different parts of the brain. In autism, they're either A, maybe fewer highways, or B, they're not all connected in the same regions that a person who developed typically would have. So you know, having, when you're interacting with a person, something that a typically developing person might find to be normal or easy is, you know, we take in someone as a package, their face, their intonation, their words, their body language, the context. We're able to process all of that simultaneously in a stream, in a flow. That's pretty effortless for the most part. But a person on the spectrum, that the highways there for processing are really different. So maybe in that moment face-to-face, there are only, you know, one highway is activated,
well,
and that one highway is the verbal.
Might be, think an HOV lane. Well, you guys, your HOV lanes are open. Here in Texas, our HOV lane is separated by concrete barriers, the one in Houston that I'm thinking of. So at certain times of day, it's only going south, and at other times of day, it's only going north because it's just one lane. And so when you get in the HOV lane, you cannot physically exit it again until you reach your destination. So you might drive by other destinations, and that's the example where you're traveling down the same path as someone else, but where they have options for where to get off, you can only get to your destination, and that's it. So, and you may even get there faster because it's the HOV lane. You're more focused on that destination. You've got no traffic getting in your way or anything. You don't have options to consider. But if you need those options, they're flying right by you and you can't get them.
You're missing the cues
along
the way.
That's like the best example ever.
Yeah. That is very good.
No, that's exactly,
The key takeaway here is that we diagnose autism with the symptoms because that's what we have. Those are the observable things that we've got. But autism isn't those symptoms. When you see it in a TV show or a movie or whatever, that's one person expressing a certain set of autism symptoms. But if you meet someone who's not showing those symptoms, that doesn't mean the autism isn't there. And the DSM covers that by saying, you know, it may not have shown it initially, and then they developed, and then they may have learned strategies to cover them. But just because they've learned strategies to cover them, just because they aren't showing the autism symptoms anymore, autism may still be there. That we don't, as of yet, have a known cure. We have a lot of things that can make life easier for someone with autism. We have people who may feel they're cured. And if you feel you're cured, and if you feel your quality of life is better, that's fine. But we don't have a cure, just something that we know works. And that's the thing. So if someone, you know, has suffered autism once in their life, it's very likely that they're still suffering some challenges from it, even if they aren't showing symptoms that you recognize anymore.
And here's a question. Maybe it's appropriate now. Maybe it's appropriate for another show, but I'm going to throw it out here. Because you talked about the neural pathways as highways, and then you gave the example about Texas, this concrete wall. That's really interesting. I wouldn't want to be in that concrete wall.
It's
like
really
the flexibility.
Narrow lane, isn't
wow.
it?
Wow. That is sort of interesting. That sounds like a Twilight Zone film.
But I just have to say on that, don't forget your question, but if
yeah.
you can imagine, so here we are, we have these two people who are trying to interact, and one person is operating, you know, with all of these highways active and flowing and what's easy for them, and you have another person who has just this one highway, and you just automatically assume that the other person has what you have.
Yeah,
you
good
know,
point.
You don't.
Well, you know, someone says, I'm on the way home from work, and you say, hey, you want to meet at Bennigan's in downtown, and they're stuck in the HOV lane. They're like, I can't get off.
Yeah.
You know, and they could tell you afterwards, you know, oh, I passed it at, you know, 445. You know, I saw it. It was right there. I couldn't go there, though. You know, and that's sort of what the experience is like, is that you may be aware of things, but there are still things you just can't do. And you can talk about it afterwards, and you can explain it, but you still couldn't do it at the time.
Now, before I ask this question, it brings up another question. Is it more frustrating for the person in the concrete lane, someone on the spectrum, or someone that sees everything but can't get through in communication?
Ooh, I want to see how Paul's going to answer.
I'm not sure.
I think my answer is pretty predictable.
It's more frustrating for people looking in, right?
I think it's more frustrating depending on the situation.
Okay.
Because misunderstanding is frustrating for anyone who encounters it. Sometimes the person on the autism spectrum may not even realize there has been one, so obviously
right.
it's less frustrating for them. Other times, you know, the person not on the spectrum may not realize that they've upset the person on the spectrum. So the person not on the spectrum goes about their day-to-day life fine, and the person on the spectrum is struggling and suffering for a couple of days while they try to recover. So I wouldn't say I could answer that question as either one because it's really situational.
And I agree with that. I was going to say that too. It really depends on the circumstances and also – you know, an example, too, is, you know, like parents, they have the best intentions. And here's the thing with autism is, you know, going back to you know, interacting with all those highways active, you know, one of those highways is being able to read communicative intent.
Mm.
And so here you have someone who loves you, who's trying to help you, and their intentions are so good, and they're doing everything that they know how to do, and that in some kind of, you know, disagreement or something's happening, it is frustrating on that end. Now, of course, you know, that's one scenario. Then you have, you know, a stranger off the street who maybe doesn't care and is, you know, the person on the spectrum is having this really, really difficult time. You know, maybe their levels of frustration will be different. So it is circumstantial, but I think a key point to look at really is communicative intent and just people being mindful of, you know, hey, we're coming from different places. You know, walking into an interaction that way, maybe this is getting off topic a little bit, I won't go there, but I think you understand what I'm trying to say.
And I think when we come back, we're going to start with the DSM-5's definition of autism, just in summary. And before that, we'd like to let people know that you can text us at 832-278-1441. And after we get past the definition, if you have any questions that really pertain to it, we may answer some of them on the air.
And you can post them on our Facebook page as well if you want to.
Yeah. That's a great idea. Give the text number out one time.
The text number is 832-278-1441.
And I'm going to throw this question out. We'll go on a break, but then you can tell me after the break if this is appropriate this time, this show, or maybe another show. You talked about the neural pathways as highways, as ways of connection or disconnection. Can you develop neural pathways with treatment? And when we come back, you could tell me it's appropriate, not appropriate, maybe a different show. I think people want to know. This is Understanding Autism Live in the Regent Suites in Phoenix, Arizona, starring Paul Alden and Kim Isaac. We'll be right back.
At Birenbaum and Spean PC, we want to help you work on your business, not in your business. We take a simple approach. You know your business. Our firm gives you the information to make those decisions better. Our firm takes a proactive approach to your accounting needs, and if you look behind the numbers, you'll find there are hidden opportunities that we try to impart on you. Communication is the key to that understanding, and there is no charge for brief phone calls. Contact us at 602-266-5633 or email us at mitch@jfbpc.com. Birenbaum and Spean works to increase your understanding of your business in order to make the decisions necessary to move your business forward.
Ridenour, Heinzen & Lewis is a multi-practice law firm ideally equipped to assist with a broad range of legal and business issues, corporate and financial transactions, real estate, commercial, litigation, bankruptcy, and private client practice. Ridenour, Heinzen & Lewis is a law firm that bases its practice on understanding the businesses of their clients, and they use this insight to meet each client's unique and evolving legal challenges. Call or click today, 602-254-9900. Find them on the web at rhkl-law.com.
Hello, I'm Jessica Olson, and I'm here to introduce you to someone whose job it is to stand together with you at the worst of times. Life throws us unexpected curveballs, including losing loved ones, caretaking, troubled retirements, job losses, and legal settlements. Meet certified financial planner Larry Moscat, who pioneered crisis financial counseling. With a background as a clinical psychology practitioner, Larry has helped numerous people see through their crises to a brighter financial future. Larry?
Thank you, Jessica. At our firm, RII Advisors in North Scottsdale, we know terrible times don't usually last, but the effects of anxiety-infused financial decisions can last a lifetime. For 30 years, our prime goal has been to introduce freedom from fear and a feeling of financial security for our clients. We then move forward with safety and best-case outcome results when it comes to the financial decisions made during the worst of times.
To learn more, log on to www.riiadvisors.com. That's RIIAdvisors.com for information on how to get help. Once again, that's RIIAdvisors.com for financial counseling during life's most challenging times.
Do you owe money to the IRS? Have you heard of possible payment options such as a partial payment installment agreement, offering compromise, or not currently collectible status? Knowing that you have options and what those options are will greatly relieve your worry and stress. Hi, my name is Dave Isaac, CPA and former government tax auditor. If you are curious as to what options may be available to you if you owe money to the IRS, my 25 years experience as a CPA may very well help you in these times of uncertainty. Stop worrying and start learning about what options you have. If you just want to talk to someone about your IRS debt or want specific advice, I invite you to call me at 602-625-3074. That is 602-625-3074. And when you call, ask for me, Dave Isaac, CPA and former government tax auditor.
And welcome back again. You are listening to Breakthrough Thinking Live here at the Regis Suites in Phoenix, Arizona, and the second Monday and Tuesday of each month from 3 to 4. It's Understanding Autism, starring Paul Loudon and Kimberly Isaac. We're talking about what autism is and is not. Very important that people understand that. We talked about DSM, which we're going to talk about what that stands for in a minute. But I did ask a question, and you may want to get sort of a short answer, and maybe it's for a different show. Can you develop neural pathways with treatment to help improve connections and see what's going on, maybe nonverbally as well as other areas of focus?
Definitely, yes. The brain is amazing. People hear the term plasticity. The brain is plastic, which means it can grow and change over time. And it's an experience-dependent organ. So setting up the right conditions for learning and growing absolutely can be developed. So as long as you don't have some sort of brain damage, which autism is not brain damage, like if you were in, you know, like an accident of some sort and have a traumatic head injury or something like that. But yes, the answer is yes, and that's a great topic that we should bring into another show.
Yeah, I expect that at some point we're going to do a show probably on the science of autism, where we talk about the various, you know, more in-depth physical aspects of it, from the brain to other physical aspects. There's been research into mitochondrial function and gut function and various other things, so we'll probably go into that. Some of the things we've talked with Dr. Adams about and sort of stop and explain some of them.
Absolutely.
So that's great hope, and we'll get into that and announce when you'll get more into that. So DSM, what does that stand for? We've said it a couple times. Paul's mentioned it. You've mentioned it. DSM, what is it?
So DSM actually, first of all, it stands for Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders. And it's a manual that has been developed by a group of psychiatrists, a board of psychiatrists. And they offer this manual to other professionals, physicians, clinical psychologists, developmental pediatricians, things like that. So even though it's been developed by psychiatrists, it's not exclusively used only by psychiatrists. Other professionals are familiar with it. And people who are qualified to diagnose autism will use that to help them make an accurate diagnosis.
And another significant use for it is just that it's also a lot of times how a diagnosis is coded for insurance purposes, in other words. So
right.
Finding a diagnosis that falls within the guidelines of the DSM, which is useful for identifying what a disorder is and what a disorder isn't, can be helpful in getting insurance help or state help or other help for a condition you may have.
And so you wanted to go into what DSM, how it looks at autism. What is autism?
Well, the DSM was revised to sort of streamline the diagnosis of autism because it fell into three categories before, and those three categories, since we were restricted to and still are restricted to diagnosing it based on behaviors and observable stuff, they sort of included some and weighted them, not necessarily right, because how many years old was the old? Was it 94, 97, something like that?
It was.
Early 90s?
Yeah, I want to say that.
The old one was really behind the curve on our understanding of a variety of things, but autism is one of them. And so research sort of helped us better understand which symptoms really were autism and which symptoms were just sort of things that might occur with it or things that might be things that people on the autism spectrum are likely to pick up or do. And so they sort of streamline the diagnosis so that it's more accurately specifically autism, so that it helps improve the treatment options for someone because, you know, you know a little better what someone has. And it sort of requires that two types of things be noticed for someone with autism. One is what they call restrictive, repetitive patterns of behaviors, interests, activities, and the other one is deficits, persistent deficits in social areas. And the way the DSM works is it'll have these categories, and it'll say you must show X number of these aspects of this category. So in the case of the social ones, it has the following things, which are deficits in social reciprocity, deficits in nonverbal communication, and deficits in understanding relationships. And so, you know, and I'm reading it, and it doesn't say how many of those. Do you need all of those in this one?
You do. I think
okay.
you need,
I think you need all
for
of those.
The social
and that's
one.
The second one that you need two of four.
Two of the four, right.
Yeah, so you need all of those. And those are sort of the long-term, harder-to-spot aspects of autism in many cases. But they're sort of – they're what I consider the real core of autism because that's what autism is these lack of understandings. And then the second part, the restrictive and repetitive patterns of behavior, they've got four categories, and you need to show marked impairment in two of them. And these are sort of the more observable behaviors, but in my opinion, a lot of them are sort of the behaviors or the things that can show up as coping mechanisms a lot of the time, but they're the most common coping mechanisms. So if you have two or four of these, you're very likely, along with the other ones, to have autism. And so these are stereotyped or repetitive motor movements, use of objects or speech, so repetitive interactions with objects or movements, and insistence on sameness, so very sort of restrictive patterns, wanting a pattern-based life, highly restricted or fixated interest, that's the kind of thing where you might see a kid who's really interested in washing machines and knows absolutely everything there is to know, washing machines or game shows. And then hypo or hyperreactivity to sensory stimulus. So that might be the kid who finds fluorescent light flickering sort of way too much for him and he can't deal with it. Or it might be the kid who, you know, doesn't react to touch almost at all because it can be either very too much or too little. And so you need all of the social ones and then two of the four of those. And then they sort of say that, like I said earlier, symptoms must be present in early childhood but may not be noticed until, you know, significant issues, and then they may be covered up. They have to cause clinically significant impairment. That means that they may have these symptoms, but the symptoms have to be bad enough that they basically interfere with an ordinary life. And then they have sort of three levels of autism, which are basically just how much help does this person need? Do they need, you know, minor help, significant help, or do they really need to be, like, you know, in constant care? And that's more of – it's not really based on identifying how bad the autism is as much as how much help this person needs from the services around them. So that's how we're diagnosing autism from a technical perspective at the moment, is that there's these guidelines that an experienced person will know how to apply and how to ask questions to uncover these aspects of a person who might be on the spectrum, their history. And so that's why, you know, parental involvement is important in a lot of cases, because you need this knowledge about when they were young. One thing you'll notice isn't there is intelligence tests or anything like that, intelligence impairment. It doesn't specifically mention language impairment, that a lot of things that you think of as likely to be with someone with autism aren't really a part of autism, and they might occur alongside of it, but they aren't necessary for diagnosis of it. So, you know, it's important, and a lot of times, you know, when I was diagnosed with autism, it included an IQ test, some hearing tests to see if maybe my not reacting to people around me was more of, you know, hearing disabilities and certain frequencies or things like that. You know, that there are a lot of tests that you think of, like, how is this diagnosing autism? But part of it is making sure that you get the right diagnosis, because if you're treating someone who has the outward symptoms of autism, but really it's because that, you know, they're half deaf or something like that, or colorblind or who knows what else, that, you know, if you're treating the wrong thing, it doesn't help them at all. So part of diagnosing autism is spotting it, but part of diagnosing autism is making sure that's what it is, and that's sort of what the DSM-5 has tried to do with these guidelines.
And honestly, the DSM is only updated, I want to say, every 10 or maybe even 13 years or something, like you were saying. So this has been long overdue, and honestly, even as it's been, the new one just came out in May. In some ways, it's definitely the most current, but we are learning so much more that I kind of wish it would come out more frequently. But it's a big
issue. And that may be something that we'll have in the future. Now that everything's electronic, the DSM could be a website that they maintain, and then they could update the autism diagnosis more often because it changes. And other diagnoses that are less likely to change, ones that we have a firmer grasp on, can be left the same. And that might help them focus their time better or make it easier for people.
Yeah. Well, why don't we take a short break, and when we come back, I want to talk a little bit about the co-occurring conditions that come alongside autism, because a lot of times those are cues, symptoms, that might trigger someone to feel like they need to go in to get a diagnosis.
All right, and this is Understanding Autism live at the Regis Suites in Phoenix, Arizona. We'll be right back.
Do you owe money to the IRS? Have you heard of possible payment options such as a partial payment installment agreement, offer in compromise, or not currently collectible status? Knowing that you have options and what those options are will greatly relieve your worry and stress. Hi, my name is Dave Isaac, CPA and former government tax auditor. If you are curious as to what options may be available to you if you owe money to the IRS, my 25 years experience as a CPA may very well help you in these times of uncertainty. Stop worrying and start learning about what options you have. If you just want to talk to someone about your IRS debt or want specific advice, I invite you to call me at 602-625-3074. That is 602-625-3074. And when you call, ask for me, Dave Isaac, CPA and former government tax auditor.
Ridenour, Heinten & Lewis is a multi-practice law firm, ideally equipped to assist with a broad range of legal and business issues, corporate and financial transactions, real estate, commercial, litigation, bankruptcy, and private client practice. Ridenour, Heinten & Lewis is a law firm that bases its practice on understanding the businesses of their clients, and they use this insight to meet each client's unique and evolving legal challenges. Call or click today, 602-254-9900. Find them on the web at rhkl-law.com.
At Beerenbaum and Spien PC, we want to help you work on your business, not in your business. We take a simple approach. You know your business. Our firm gives you the information to make those decisions better. Our firm takes a proactive approach to your accounting needs, and if you look behind the numbers, you'll find there are hidden opportunities that we try to impart on you. Communication is the key to that understanding, and there is no charge for brief phone calls. Contact us at 602-266-5633 or email us at mitch@jfbpc.com. Beerenbaum and Spien works to increase your understanding of your business in order to make the decisions necessary to move your business forward.
And welcome back again. You are listening to Breakthrough Thinking live at the Regis Suites in Phoenix, Arizona, every second Monday and Tuesday of each month from 3 to 4, Understanding Autism, starring Paul Alden and Kimberly Isaac. We're talking about what autism is and is not. And we left off, Kim, you were talking about co-occurring conditions. Why don't you explain that?
Well, sometimes people have co-occurring conditions, and they lump those conditions into the idea of the autism itself. But what's actually happening is when a person has autism, their likelihood of having a co-occurring condition is higher. So examples of these conditions might be anxiety, depression, ADD, ADHD, OCD, that's obsessive compulsive disorder, ODD, which is oppositional defiant disorder. Epilepsy even is very common, very common. In fact, I think I just read 33% of people with autism either have epilepsy or develop it.
Do they know why that is?
That's still undergoing a lot of research.
We still don't know what causes autism, but it's beginning to look like there are a variety of causes, and some of those are environmental or nutritional. And with environmental and nutritional causes, if they can cause damage to how your brain develops, they can also cause damages to how your immune system develops, how your digestive system, any system in your body. So the same kind of damage that can create delays in one place can create delays and disorders in others. So it's that kind of thing. I suspect that it's going to show in the long term that people with epilepsy are also more likely to have autism and so on.
There are a lot of commonalities.
Bidirectional connections, but that's, for the future.
Yeah, and some other things, too, that people might think is, having a speech delay or a motor impairment, and what I mean by that is like a physical impairment, being able to move your body in certain ways. So some people on the spectrum, that's why they call it a spectrum, have some of these extra things, and some do not. And it's important to identify, what's what and not lump everything into this is the autism, which brings us really to give you a little sneak peek at tomorrow's show.
Yeah.
You want to talk about it?
Okay. Tomorrow we're going to be talking about the more practical side of this. We've gone over sort of a bunch of definitions and a bunch of sort of technical details. So tomorrow we're going to be talking about what autism is in the real world. So we're going to talk a little more about, we've given you some of the diagnostic criteria and some brief examples, but we're going to talk about, what it might look like to you if you have a child who has autism or if you have a friend who has autism, and what autism is in reality as opposed to in the textbook.
Which is really valuable because there's so many listeners out there and they're curious right now as we speak, does my child have some symptoms? What do I look for? And is that the type of things you're going to talk about, is what to look for or actively look for or just randomly notice?
I wouldn't say it's going to be necessarily what to look for, but I think giving examples of things people may be experiencing may trigger questions in their mind. And I also want to say, too, not just for parents who have kids, but if you're an adult listening and you suspect maybe you have autism, maybe you'll be able to relate to some of the experiences that will be shared, and it might trigger some thought as to, taking a step towards figuring it out.
And as well, because this is all part of our What is Autism, if you had some questions about what we talked about earlier in the show and you weren't ready to ask it yet or you weren't quite sure what you want to ask and it comes to you, 5 minutes after we go off the air and you're just like, oh, shoot, you'll be able to ask them on our Facebook page and we'll get back to them tomorrow, hopefully.
Well, that's excellent. And as a little bit more of a preview, can you give one example of what an experience versus a behavior would be?
Oh, my gosh, we don't have time for that.
Well, that's quite a bit, huh?
It is quite a bit. We only have 3 minutes left in the show.
Yes.
But, no, we'll have plenty of that tomorrow for sure. I know you're on the edge of your seat with this one.
Oh, yeah, this is so valuable. We have about 3 minutes left, it seems like. So, Kim and Paul, maybe Kim go first. How valuable is this? Because there's such, to me, I think there's just misinformation out there. How valuable is something like what you and Paul are doing?
Well, I feel like it's very valuable in that, we're able to share different kinds of perspectives on a real life issue and a life issue that's, more and more common. It's the number one fastest growing developmental disability in the United States. And so I feel like what's valuable is for us to really share our thought processes on it and have a nice mix of some technical things with life experience and, the goal is to encourage people and
give them
hope.
One thing is the CDC listed as 1 in 88 people would be diagnosed with autism or have been diagnosed with autism in whatever the age group is, but that we're seeing more and more of it. It's 1 in 55 men. If you think about it, the average person who has, say, 250 Facebook friends, not counting the fact that maybe people with autism are less social on Facebook and just assuming an even distribution, that means that 2.5 of those people have autism on your 250 Facebook friends. That there's so many people out there with autism who maybe are hiding it or don't know they have it, but maybe struggling with it. And the awareness of it in media and everything is so limited that being able to talk about it and give people other examples just so they have a broader view of it rather than the narrow view they may have seen in one movie or one TV show can really help just people interact with each other. So the more we talk about autism at all, the better, because, you know, even if we get minor details wrong here or there, or even if someone disagrees with what we said, it gives them the opportunity to think about it in a new way or just to think about it again, reminds them that this is a thing.
I agree.
And
yeah.
Kim, you wanted to make a parting comment too.
Well, I do. Well, I want to thank all of our listeners for sure. Thank you for listening, and we love you on Facebook. And also just want to really give sincere appreciation for all the veterans out there, for everybody who served our country. We really appreciate you. We hope you're enjoying a nice long weekend with your family.
Yeah, that's great. Great comment. Paul Alden, Kim Isaac, thank you so much again. We'll be on tomorrow, but we have a People and Games.
Yeah, we have People and Games at 2 tomorrow and Understanding Autism at 3. Hopefully, People and Games, we have a guest who will be talking about his game, The Stanley Parable. If not, I'll be talking about his game, The Stanley Parable, if anything goes wrong, but it should be exciting.
That should be great. I love that show. And of course, this is Breakthrough Thinking live from the Regis Suites in Phoenix, Arizona. Stay tuned tomorrow, 2 o'clock, People and Games, 3 o'clock, Understanding Autism. And that is, you know, the time has changed. So we're Phoenix, Arizona time. What is that, mountain time?
Currently we're on mountain
time. We're in mountain time. So 2 to 3 tomorrow, People and Games, 3 to 4 tomorrow, Understanding Autism. Everyone have a great night. Talk to you tomorrow.